What's up?
All right. What's going on, Joe? Good talking to you.
Likewise. So we talk often, actually. Yeah.
I think we keep like popping into each other or bouncing into each other like in random spots.
Really random spots. When's the last time we hung out?
That's right. Last time was Vegas, right? Vegas, it was, I think it was during reInvent.
Yep.
A lot of stuff going on, a lot of cool stuff and interesting stuff. But yeah, we got a chance to kind of catch up and
that was dope.
You know, meet old friends.
Meet old friends. Yeah, reInvent's an interesting one because it seems like everybody's there, but there's a million things going on. And I think everyone expects to bump into each other, but it's almost like you literally need to bump into each other because there's just too much happening.
That's right.
Planning a meeting there is, I just kind of stopped for the most part, like having an agenda showing up. Cause it's just like,
yeah, that's the way goals. To do it.
Yeah.
I've had a long list of folks and friends that I was planning to catch up with and meet up, and like we're texting and emailing, let's meet up. And then none of it ever happened. And I feel bad cause I really want to catch up with these people, but there's just no time for anyone.
No, it's just a place. You just have a sea of disappointment in your text when you look through it, and it's just like, yeah, I didn't meet with that person, didn't meet with that other person. So it is what it is. For people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Yeah, sure. So Roy Hassan again. I work for Upsolver right now. I'm the VP of product there. Also have some responsibility for marketing, something a little bit new for me, but I really enjoy it.
Oh, sick.
Came from a long line of data, networking, hardware, engineering stuff, post-sales, pre-sales. I really did a lot of stuff. I think I have a very colorful background.
Let's get into that, because right before the we hit record, you're telling me about some of the things you're doing. It's like, I had no idea you did that or the other thing you said or anything like that. So yeah, walk me through, like, how did you get to today?
Yeah, that's a good one, because I always talk to people in the data industry, and you know, they're like, oh, I worked on databases and I was a DBA, and I'm like, I don't think I've ever done that, and you know, aside from my own like fun projects, but never was a DBA. But you know, my career really started in the service provider space. So I worked for Comcast for about 5 years back in 2001. That's where I actually worked on some really cool stuff. So like we built the first ever cable modem network for Comcast. So
wow.
Like if you're surfing the web today and you're a customer of Comcast or Time Warner or Cablevision or Cox or one of those, I built that first network for Comcast. And then from there it expanded into other service providers. So that was really awesome, where you get to learn, you know, cable networks, like how the hell do you transmit data over, you know, coax cables, and you know how that works, and it was fun. But I don't know if you got a question.
What was your educational background?
So I went to RIT. I started computer engineering. I didn't really stay with it. Ended up with computer science. But I was really a hands-on person. I really loved, you know, building and connecting and troubleshooting. I actually enjoy that. I did a bunch of, you know, software hacking and cracking in my college years. Nice. Nothing too illegal, but it was fun.
That you'll talk about it, at least. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I can talk about it. So I did a bunch of that. I really enjoyed it, and you know, kind of came out of college and like, you know, I want to write code, but I'm not sure I really want to write code. I don't know. It's not that much fun. So I just went into, you know, building stuff and joined Comcast. I knew some folks there that kind of got me the first interview, and that was it from there on. And I stayed in the service provider space for about, I don't know, 12 to 15 years, something like that. I can't remember.
Jeez. Even.
I worked on the first cable modem network, and then we transitioned. We build voice over IP. So,
dang.
You know, the whole hot voice over IP, cool thing that now we take for granted. We built that on top of the cable modem network. So got to learn telephony, got to learn how does that whole thing work? You know, SS7 networks and all that legacy stuff that we all kind of depend on nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool, really interesting. Got to build the whole back end and, you know, the infrastructure and stuff like that. So that was fun. And then kind of continued in that space, worked for Motorola, spent some time on video networks, you know, kind of like Fios video, Comcast video that you get today. I worked on a lot of that, how to improve those networks, how to deliver HD TV signals in on existing coax, you know, more compression and a bunch of stuff like that. So yeah, did a lot of that and then kind of came to an end and just said, like, you know what, I need something different. I need something more modern, something that can challenge me and I can do kind of fun things that I've not done before. And I said, you know what, let's go look at AWS. A buddy of mine was already working at AWS at that time in 2006. They were doing a bunch of like hiring blitz where they just kind of like bring a bunch of people. You know, you go through an interview and then at the end of the day, they sort of make a decision. So say, what the hell, go give it a shot. So I did that. I eventually joined as a technical account manager, which is like a post-sales engineer.
Yeah.
Kind of working with customers of AWS to do whatever they needed to do. So I didn't really have a particular specialty. I just was really good at building stuff and troubleshooting stuff. And I did that. Did that for about a year as one of my first roles. And that's where I got kind of introduced to data analytics. A bunch of my customers, some ad tech, some banks, and others that were really kind of delving into data and doing a bunch of analytics stuff. This is early days, still Hive. This is when Spark was really starting to get started. I think it was probably like 0.6, Spark 0.6 or something like that. Eventually went to 1.0. And that's where I got more involved building stuff. I had a really good partner that worked with me. We worked as pairs on a set of customers. And he had this amazing idea that I still to this day thank him. And he's basically said, like, you know what? We're both learning a bunch of this new stuff. Why don't we do this? Why don't we, each one of us, like you start the week, you take full responsibility of our customers for the whole week while he goes and learns, right? Spends time learning, building. At the end of that week, we teach each other. And then we switch. I go learn something new and he takes over emails, alerts, all that customer stuff. And then the end of the week, we learn. And kind of we teach each other. And we did that. We did that for a few months. We learned Spark. We learned Hive. We learned Presto at that time. We learned a whole bunch of stuff around data. And then we took that and we actually created lunch and learns for our customers. Like, we learned how to do, you know, why is partitioning in Spark important? We learned the inner workings of Spark. And we did lunch and learns for our customers. And that was so awesome because we learned a ton and our customers learned a ton. And that really got me involved in data and him as well. And then we started jumping into more troubleshooting and you know, rewriting code and working with customers to build ETL pipelines. And we did a lot of Hive and MapReduce migration to Spark. That wasn't fun, but
yeah, that's horrible. Yeah,
it was pretty cool to see the performance improvements, like the quick wins that we were able to get. And there was one that I did a migration for a pharmaceutical company. They have like a Hive MapReduce job that took, I think it was like 19 hours to join like two data sets together. And wow. I think they had about like a 20 some node cluster. And I brought it down after, I don't know, it took about a month, but brought it down to like 7 minutes running on Spark on a significantly smaller cluster. I think it was like probably 10 nodes. That was a huge win. That was awesome. That's
a huge win.
See that, yeah.
19 hours to 7 minutes. Well, back then, I mean, thinking for the audience, you got to remember around this time, a lot of things are still Hadoop based, and so and back then MapReduce, so a lot of it was and the operations had to be done on disk for the most part, memory operations. That's where Spark came in handy, is that Spark was really it touted itself as being like, what, 100 times faster, I think, than
a bunch of numbers,
but I think it was one of the numbers. I remember seeing that with but because you could do most of the operations in memory, right? So that, yeah, for the audience out there that kind of maybe weren't familiar with the time back then, think MapReduce was becoming under the scene, but it was it was kludgy for a lot of reasons. Writing MapReduce code meant you literally had to map and reduce your operations, which is very counterintuitive. And then you, for a lot of people, and then you had to, again, a lot of it was disk-based operations, so it just was slow, right? That's, but what you describe as Spark, I mean, saw that too, where it's saw just huge gains because it should work better that way.
I mean, memory, running everything in memory was a significantly big improvement over MapReduce. I think the other thing that Spark brought in that people initially kind of struggled or didn't really know what it was is kind of like, how do you work with the query planner slash optimizer to get the best out of it, right? Do you broadcast join or do you not? Do you, you know, do you repartition your data based on a join key or do you not? Like if you do it on a large table, how long, you know, is that going to take a long time? Are you going to suck up a lot of memory because you're shuffling stuff? You know, so there's a bunch of things like that, that, you know, unless you tinker with it and you play and you experiment and you benchmark, like you're not going to know the impact they're going to have. And some will work in some cases, and then they will not work in other cases. You know, I was lucky to kind of find the right combination of of levers and knobs that made that solution work so much better. But that was cool. That was a lot of fun. And honestly, like that work for me, AWS, like that work that I did really resonated with the service team, the EMR service team.
Oh, I bet.
I also built like EMR is really cool because EMR is like the, you know, the big data platform for AWS. And they have this concept of bootstrap actions where you can kind of install and load whatever you want on top of an EMR cluster. This is just a cluster of nodes. They automatically load Hadoopy stuff on it, but you can write a bootstrap action to load something else. So I did that for Spark 2.0. And this is before 2.0 was really public, because one of my customers, like, I need 2.0 because it has a bunch of optimizations that are going to save me a ton of time, but EMR doesn't come with it. So how do we get it loaded? So I set it up. I did that. I loaded it, showed a bunch of people how to use it, and they got massive wins just because of that. And then I showed that to the service team, and they're like, awesome, let's do more of this. And that really got me into the data space. And that's kind of where I think my career, my second act, you know, really started.
Instead of cable modems, I'm just kidding. Which is cool. Technically difficult work for sure, but data is definitely a... But I'm sure there's some threads which we get into, which I think that it's funny because you have... I mean, my career is sort of the same where I've had a lot of varying experiences, but it's... As you start tying everything together, everything sort of comes full circle at some point. Where you say, oh yeah, that thing that I did way back then, which seems very might not seem related, actually is hugely significant, right? And I'm sure that those threads will pop up as we chat. But I mean, you're talking about definitely a time and place, because again, for the audience, this is around when I think it was sort of in the heat of the big data era. But this was around the time too. I think people were starting to figure out that a lot of the big data tooling was fairly complicated to use. I remember using Spark when it first came out as well, and it was great, except RDDs were they're not very fun to work with. I'm glad that the abstractions, 2.0 got a lot better and so forth. But it is what it is. It was still better than...
It's the early days. Needed to know what you really had to understand this stuff. And it's not a matter of just writing some SQL or writing some Python code and kind of washing your hands clear. Just you had to actually know how it works. You have to know how it compiles. You have to know how it behaves, because like one little thing could have completely derailed your job and cause it to crash. And if you rewrote your code slightly differently, all of a sudden it works perfectly.
Well, that was even the case with Hive.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because you're dealing with a shuffle operation typically and all this other background noise, and it's harder to reconcile with. And then with RDDs, I mean, I don't think SQL was available in the first part of Spark. As far as
in the beginning, there was no Spark SQL. It was heavily RDD, and then eventually Scala and data frames that got a little bit easier.
Yeah. So, you know, but those are fun times. I mean, because you felt like a total nerd working on just some cool tech, and then fast forward to today, and everything's like super simple comparatively. It's like you don't really need to think about this stuff
anymore. Yeah, I mean, there's good and bad, right? I mean, the super simple stuff, the abstractions, like cool, I can just write one line of code, and then a whole lot of magic happens behind the scenes. But what you don't understand is what actually happens, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you go from this is a toy, a little bit of data, no big deal, to this is a lot of data, this is a truly business impacting type of job, you want to know what's under the hood. You want to know how those abstractions are actually executing code behind the scenes. And there's so many layers that, like, how do you troubleshoot it? Like I keep saying, you know, I've had a few customers in the beginning that use, you know, Delta Lake, Databricks Delta Lake, and Data Live Tables, which are like abstractions on top of abstraction on top of another abstraction. I'm like, it's cool. It's easy to use. It's awesome. But what if something breaks? What do you do? Mm-hmm. Right? There's no easy way for you to get to the bottom of it and really understand what the problem is, right? And I think that's kind of the challenge that we see today is like as an industry, I think we overemphasize on ease of use, which is important, right? We want to make it easier for more users to use these tools, but we don't pay enough attention to transparency, right? Like I made it super easy for you to use, but I also took away a lot of transparency. If you need to troubleshoot something, good luck, right? Come and talk to me. But that's not the way we should be doing things. Like, you should make it easy, but you should also give me the option to open the hood, see what's doing. If I need to tune and tweak, I have the option. But if I don't want to and I just want to understand what happens, show me, right?
Yeah.
Because we make a lot of assumptions for the user. And if the user doesn't know those assumptions, things don't always go well.
Yeah, I totally agree. We'll loop back to this in a bit, but one other part of your career, which I find interesting, is from when you were at TAM, and I've had lots of friends who have been TAMs, AWS, seems like a fun work. You just get to work on all sorts of fun problems, but you jumped to where you were with Glue. What did you do with Glue? Because I think that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so actually there's a step before that.
Okay.
So like I did a lot of this Spark stuff, got together with the service team, the EMR service team, helped onboard some new customers onto Spark 2.0, and eventually they kind of took over that piece. After that, Amazon Athena actually became
a thing. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we kind of participated in that. I was a big fan and user of Presto on EMR. Mm-hmm. And then when Amazon Athena got launched, I really took to it. I really liked what they were doing. I really loved the service. I still really love the service. I think it's an awesome service. So I got more involved in that. I worked very closely with the service team. I kind of became the first sort of solution architect / data engineer person that helps onboard new customers to the platform. Now, the problem with Presto then, still a little bit of a problem today, is that it's a great query engine for data in an object store, like on S3, for example.
Yeah.
But performance heavily depends on the data and the way that you lay out and structure your data. And if you don't know how to do that and you don't know what those best practices are, you're not going to get the performance that you want.
You're talking about partitioning your
partitioning, parquet format, sorting, those kind of things. And most users of Athena were not data engineers. They were people who just analysts, people who just run around query. So they had no idea what this stuff is. And we kind of published some content around it and said, hey, here are some best practices, here's things you can do, which sounds great. But nobody knew how to do it. All right. Like, I tell you to partition the data, you look at me sideways, like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I just want to run a query. Right.
Because there's two ways you could look at that. Analysts wouldn't know what you mean by partitioning. They'd just be like, I have no idea. But then a DBA would say, what do you mean by partition? I have to shard it now or that kind of partitioning.
Yeah. So, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It was really confusing.
Uh-huh. Actually, I do have a question for you about Athena before we kind of jump back. Why? I've always wondered this, and maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, maybe you're not allowed to, but like, why is it that they had Redshift and then they have Athena?
So without getting into sort of like the underlying, the real reasons why things happen, but Redshift was a data warehouse, right? Yeah. Redshift was built to kind of like replace the traditional data warehouse with cloud native technologies. So give you the scale, give you the performance and the cost savings that you'd expect from a cloud native data warehouse, right? With all the same capabilities and power and ease of use of a traditional warehouse. Athena was brought on to be able to offer a way for you to do ad hoc interactive analytics without the cost and complexity of a warehouse. So what if you just simply wanted to run a query on your data? You don't want to maintain clusters or warehouses or deal with workflow management and all that stuff. You just want to run a query, right? So Athena was really about, hey, I got a query to run. I'm just going to pay you for that particular query. And once that's done, it goes away and I don't have to deal with clusters or management or DBAs right. or any of that stuff. So that was really the gist of why Athena came to be. And that was really attractive to a lot of people. Like serverless. I love serverless analytics.
Oh, I was using it a lot.
Yeah. Well, what's there not to like, right? The cost model was super.
The only thing I didn't like is that I had to go back to Redshift if I wanted to put the data back into Redshift. It's like, can these just be the same thing?
Right, but, right, right.
Yeah.
So it's still a little bit of that balance. Like, when do you use one over the other? But I think Athena is kind of caught up a lot with the functionality. The challenge that you have with Athena is that it's still querying data in S3, right? So you still have that network round trip. Mm-hmm. And kind of physics gets in the way a little bit where the query performance is in the minutes, right? If you're really, really good at optimizing, you can get it to the, you know, hundreds of seconds, but it's mostly in the single digit minutes where your performance is. So if you need interactive dashboards, Redshift is still the right choice for that because you're going to get, you know, sub-minute response times for queries and stuff like that. But I do see a lot of users still using Athena for notebooks, interactive queries through notebooks, ad hoc queries, analysis. If you want to look at security logs, you know, infrastructure logs, it's a great way to do it. You don't need to keep a cluster going.
Yeah. Okay. So derailed you. So you're with Athena becoming sort of the data engineer and expert for that, for customer facing stuff.
Yeah.
And then,
So I spent a bunch of time on Athena, you know, helped a lot of our internal users, like our internal SAs and teams, kind of start using it and learning how to talk to their customers about it. Onboarded, you know, our largest, you know, first customers to the platform. Many of the ones that I brought to the platform are still in the Athena top 10.
Nice.
Which is cool. It was like really, really cool usage. And then I transitioned to actually a business development role. So within the company, this BD role opened up to say, hey, Athena, Redshift, analytics is starting to become a big thing. How do we talk to customers about it? How do we talk to the market about it? How do we talk to partners about it? So I sort of took that role. It was businessy. It was technical. It let me do a lot of things. That I really wanted to do. So I wasn't kind of stuck in one bucket. I could do more things, which I enjoyed. So I started doing that. I did that for Athena for a little bit, did that for EMR for a little bit. And then Glue came onto the scene, right? Mm. So we launched Glue. I was part of the early days of Glue, the launch of that as well.
Around what year was that?
Say again?
Around what year was that?
So Athena was around 2007, I want to say. So Glue was probably 09-ish, maybe. I should probably look it up before.
Wait, Glue was 09-ish? I thought Athena came out like 20. Oh, we can Google this too.
No. I'm sorry. Sorry.
2016. Yeah, because I remember Glue. I started using it in 2016 when it came out. Yeah, it's like, is that around for that long? It's crazy.
Athena was, I think, 2016. Was Glue. Yeah.
Okay. That seems about right. It's like. Gosh.
Sorry, I got I'm not that good at that. Yeah, I think it was around 2016. There was a big announcement at reInvent.
Yeah.
That year, and then Glue was sort of teased there.
Yeah.
But I think we eventually launched it. I want to say it was either the New York Summit or the San Francisco Summit.
Mm.
It was launched in one of those. I'm really bad with.
Oh, don't worry. That's fine. Don't worry about it.
So I kind of did the same stuff I did for Athena, but for Glue, and because I had all that experience with Spark on EMR, I carried all that experience into Glue. So I spent a ton of time with people, you know, migrating the Spark workloads from Cloudera and, you know, on-prem Hadoop stuff, and even EMR and Databricks over to Glue.
That's dope.
Yeah.
At Glue, when it came on the scene, I was pleasantly surprised and excited because it was it definitely seemed to solve a lot of problems I was having, mainly that, as you point out, querying object storage, for example, like with Athena, was a bit painful if they're just plain objects. And I think like right. having that it was like a Hive metadata catalog on top of the data, right? Is that what was underlying?
So Glue had a data catalog. Yeah, okay. Glue had a catalog as its own, or you can use the standalone Hive.
So it made that super convenient, right? So you had the notion of a crawler. The thing that I always found interesting was that it was sort of an ETL engine, but also a data catalog. Not in the traditional sense, I would say, like in the sense where you're like writing up your definitions and storing it, but it was like it was a way of cataloging, I think, from a metadata perspective, which I thought
the service was a little confusing because it sort of embodied multiple components.
Yeah.
Right. So it had the ETL component, which is serverless Spark. It had the Glue data catalog, which is a replacement for the Hive metastore. And then it had this concept of crawlers.
Yep.
And crawlers were the thing that just goes out and discovers your data and updates the Glue catalog with that information. that was a way that we used to sort of help people take the data that they already have in S3 and just onboard it into a data lake, like create a data lake out of that. And that was super helpful. I mean, it had issues. It wasn't perfect, but it did a really good job at onboarding new data into the data lake very, very quickly. And the Glue catalog till this day, I think it's one of the most useful services. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it from a data catalog perspective, there's so much dependence on it by the big data ecosystem.
Oh yeah.
And there's really one tool. It's called Hive Metastore. And barely anybody's touching it, right? There's a little bit of community development around it. Facebook still kind of manages a little bit, but it really hasn't seen any features or major performance improvement or stability improvements. It's just kind of like chugging along. So if you
it's everywhere though.
It's everywhere, yes. Everywhere. And everything depends on it. So if that thing, somebody stops maintaining it or there's an issue and so like nobody fixes it, what happens, right? So like we can't all depend on one thing that, very few people really maintain. So the Glue catalog really came in and kind of replaced that in a lot of places. It still has its issues, right? It's not perfect, but at least AWS is behind it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was awesome. So Glue kind of like managing the whole ecosystem, getting customers onboarded was great. And then after my stint as a BD, I became a PM.
Nice.
I switched to product management.
Joined the dark side.
I kind of moonlit a little bit as a PM on Athena and served a little bit as a PM on Glue in the early days, even though I was still BD, but I sort of did a lot of the tasks of a PM because the teams were really small. And then I kind of became a full-time PM for Glue and also Lake Formation, which was the security service for AWS. So that was a whole new experience. As you can see, my career kind of jumps around from different things. I'm really good at getting my hands dirty and getting into the details very, very fast, so I can kind of become an expert in the thing that I want to go do. Mm-hmm. Like business development, I've never done that. Data, never done that until I started learning. Product management was the first time I really did product management, like for real.
Yeah.
And just kind of both feet in and learned as much as I could and just did the work, right?
It's often the best way to learn, especially in a fast moving field like we're in. I would say I think everyone learns differently. Like I tend to be very methodical, but it all kind of builds in itself. Sorry. But it all has an intention too. Like you're definitely, for me at least, I pay attention a lot more to the stuff that's in front of me than I will. Like, this is something I might need to know 5 years from now. Like, I don't know, probably
right.
won't ever need to know that 5 years from now. So
I think the challenge is that we're so distracted by our day to day and the things we got to get done for the current job that if you really want to change to a different role, like you have to make that your day to day. Like you can't just say, true. I want to be a PM, but my job right now is data engineering. You'll never do the PM thing because you're too focused on your day to day, which is okay. But how do you make whatever you want to become the day to day, or at least part of your day to day, so you can get the experience?
Yeah. It's hard.
That's the challenge. And that's the feedback I give to a lot of folks. I still kind of mentor a lot of folks that I met at AWS that reach out to me like, how did you jump around from so many different roles? And, you know, honestly, I just came in and, you know, for lack of a better term, I just, you know, I kind of lied and said like, yeah, of course I can do this. you know, just give me a chance. And I did. But I showed it. I showed that I could do it.
Yeah, you have to prove it too. but you're the kind of guy that picks things up pretty fast. So it's, I think, yeah. You're gonna actually.
I think it's important to have the confidence in yourself that you can do it.
Yeah.
If somebody says like, have you done any PM work in the past? It's okay to say yes. I've had a few experiences. Like, I'm not an expert at it, but I've had experiences, and I'm ready to get my hands dirty and do this. And
yeah,
you know, do the pre-work, right? Learn how to speak the language. Learn how to, you know, what are some of the challenges inside of this little market that you want to get into, and then put your head down and do the work.
How does that work at a company like Amazon? Is it one of those places where people will take a shot on you because you show a capability for moving fast, picking up things fast, and delivering? Or is it more of a place where it's like, sorry, you haven't reached these series of steps yet, and so you have to.
No. AWS is very much a prove it culture. So they want to get more people involved in projects. They're very open to moving people around. Like, your manager would support you 100% to move to different things.
That's cool.
But you have to prove it. Like, typically with AWS, just because there's so many people and so many different opportunities, it's hard to bring people in. Like, you have to take the extra step in advance to prove yourself. Like, when I did all the work with EMR and Spark, I wasn't really planning to move into data to do any of that stuff, but that's the pre-work that I did. I sort of went on my own. I did this work. After I finished the work, I went to the service team and say, oh, by the way, look at what I did. Right. And that helped. Right. It wasn't the end, but it did help. It kind of got the door open. It got the conversation going. And then people say like, hey, you have this experience and this experience. Maybe you can fit in this role. Go do this role for a year or two and then see what's the next thing for you. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's really the way to do it. So, you know, resumes and things like that. I don't see that unless you're going into a completely different field.
Yeah.
It's a matter of, you know, you gotta do the work that you want to be doing in the future.
Yeah.
And that's what you use to demonstrate your abilities.
That's so true. That's advice I give to, even new graduates too, you know, because they're asking how do I get my foot in the door, and it's like, I think a lot of it's just showing up. You know, if there's meetups in your area, show up and make friends with engineers. You know, get to know the people who you'll be working with eventually. I think people will sense your enthusiasm, you know, and might take a shot on you at some point. I mean, I've done that with people. I've hired them onto my teams who I met at meetups and were unproven from a resume perspective. And like, this person has the enthusiasm that a lot of people at my work probably don't even have. So, you know,
you got to want to do the work. I see a lot of new folks coming into the market that just kind of want the recognition, they want the opportunity, they want to be brought in, and then I'll show you I can do the work. You need to show the work now. Like,
that's crazy. People feel like they can just show up and like, that's how it is.
Yeah, it is. That's what they think. And I'm like, kind of need to show something, like make the effort. Like, at a minimum, go learn my problems. Go learn my industry. Go learn my market. Go learn what I do before you come and ask for a job, right?
That's bananas.
Yeah. It's there's so much opportunity for people. Like we said, the job market is really tough. It is tough, but I think the people who get jobs are the people who get work done.
Yep.
You just have to put your head down and do the work. I always say this. I even say it to my kids. You know, you can blame your teachers. You can say they didn't tell you about the test or when this happened or they didn't teach you this and that. Just enough. At the end of the day, it's your grade, not their grade.
Yeah.
Your work that you need to do, put your head down and go figure it out. Go get it done.
Yeah. I had the talk with my 10-year-old the other day. He was not doing too well on an assignment. And he was like, he's blaming everybody, you know, and it's kind of like, said to pull him aside. And I was like, dude, you know, I want you to point your finger.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Just point. And I want you to point at whose fault it is that you're not putting in the time to do your homework. Is it me? Is it your mom or is it you? Right. And so he figured it out. I told him, you know, when you're older, when you're an adult, you're not going to get this luxury of pointing your finger at other people. You know, this is you got to learn this lesson now. And if you're going to be pointing your finger and not taking accountability, you're going to have a really rough go at a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So it won't last very long.
Nope, not at all. But I think it's the expectation though. You know, I finished college. I got all these, I got these certs. Like, you know, I definitely need to get a job. And I'm like, it doesn't, that'll get you. Yeah. At least maybe we'll look at your resume, but yeah, it's an interesting one. But learning is one of those things, like you say, continuous learning. And I think just kind of stumbling into new opportunities and opening yourself up to them, I think is one of the big keys, absolutely. You know?
Yeah. And then I'll add one more thing and not to jinx it or to, you know,
jinx away. It's fine.
Not to jinx it, to brag it all. But like, if I look back in my career, like honestly, the only real interview I had is when I went into AWS. Mm. Every other job that I change into, and I've changed a lot. I stayed around. Like my first job was 5 years, and then I switched every 2 to 3 years. None of them I had interviews. Like I didn't interview. I just basically reached out to my network. Like, hey, I'm looking to leave. Interested in this area. People knew me. People knew that I got work done. People knew that I got. When I said I did something, I'm going to do it. And I did it. And that's the trust that you build in the people that you work with, that in the future, if you know you're stuck or you lost your job or something like that, you can tap into your market or to your network, and you can basically say, like, I need help. And people know you, they trust you, they know you're a good worker, they know that you know your stuff. And honestly, that's kind of how I bounced around. And once I got into AWS, it was the same thing. Like, I didn't really have to re-interview in anywhere else. They knew me. They knew what I can do. And that's, I think that's really, really important. Like, if you want to have a secure or a safe career, you got to get the job done. You got to work hard. You got to put in the time. You got to do the things that you say that you're going to do.
Yeah. Right? Well, it's all about reputation. You know?
Absolutely.
And it's key. And other people are going to be staking their reputation on you if they're going to give you a shot. So, I mean, one of the only things I ask people, if you're going to recommend a candidate, especially if it's an employee, like, are you willing to risk your job on this person?
Right.
Because if it goes south, I might have to have second thoughts. You know, obviously some weird things happen, but it's like, I want people to take it that seriously, where, you know, you're going to bet your reputation on this if it matters to you. And if it doesn't, then that kind of tells me also what you think about this person. So,
I mean, if I get asked for recommendations, it's people that, like you said, it's people that I'm going to put my trust and faith.
Vouch for them. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And like I said, weird stuff does happen. Like, I remember, you know, I've had people on teams and a year into it, just something changes in the personality and I can't account for it. And that also happens, but that's, it's an interesting one. I think maybe the big theme of this is just sort of career progressions, it seems like, because it's one of these things where it's very nonlinear, I feel like, where, you know, when you start out, you think you're going to be doing one thing and,
that's right.
You know, I never had any career goals. It's kind of weird. Like I never really had anything where I was like, you know, I got to be, I got to hit the C level by this age or something like that. I was just never, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. It's funny because my first boss at Comcast, I love him very much. I mean, he's such an awesome guy. He's been my mentor throughout my career. But, you know, he always said to me, like, look, in your 20s, put your head down, work. Do what people ask you to do. Don't ask questions. Just get work done.
Uh-huh. Right?
In your 30s, bounce around. Try different things. Try different roles. Try different skill sets, different companies. That's your time to bounce around. When you get to your 40s, start to settle. Find that one space, like product or business or marketing, that you really enjoy, that you're really good at. And just stay in one place a little bit longer, right? Because what you notice is, like, if you bounce around every 2 to 3 years, you sort of build a lot of trust and confidence within the company of your abilities, and then you leave.
Yep.
Right? So just when things were about to get better for you and people start believing in you and giving you bigger responsibilities, you leave, right? So in your 30s, that's okay, right? Go try different things. But in your 40s, like, you've built enough trust and confidence and skill set, like, stay. Stick around, wait for that bigger opportunity to evolve, and then you can take it. And in your 50s, that's kind of where you pick your spot, you sit your butt down, And that's it. You should be happy here, right? This is where you collect your paycheck and you make your money. And that's it. And that's an advice I've given other people too, that are kind of like fumbling around and trying, like, I don't know what to do. Like, I want product, I want this. Like, this is kind of like the progression that I've seen and that I've followed as well. And it worked well for me. I think towards like the end of my 30s, I start seeing where, you know, companies, I stayed 2 to 3 years, and I can, when I left, just as I left, they're like, why the hell did you leave? Like, we had a big project, we're gonna give this to you. I'm like, oh, you know, why did I leave? But you know what? It was okay. At the end of the day, it's all learning lessons.
It all works out. I want your advice though, because I mean, I'm a, you know, my towards the later part of my 40s, right? And I see you know, I'm guessing you're probably in the same age bracket, just old at this point.
I am. Yeah.
So one thing I noticed, I mean, it's interesting because the advice is to definitely kind of stay where you are if you can. But what I see with a lot of people our age is they're looking for something else, right? You call it a midlife crisis, you call it whatever it is, but it's like everyone I know in our age group is the kind of questioning. I would say almost everybody, not everybody. Some people are like happy, like I'm perfectly happy doing what I'm doing. Like I think I found like the bliss and the nirvana, so to speak. Like what I do doesn't feel like work. I'm very thankful for that opportunity. A lot of people I know aren't like that. Like they feel like it's like, you know, what the hell am I supposed to be doing now? Like, is this it? Like, should I do this for another 20 years? Like that's, you know, so I mean, what do you think about that?
It's a good question. Cause I've been thinking about it as well. Look, I think everything that you do has a shelf life.
Yeah. Right?
You know, you can go and do your own thing and do content and podcasts and stuff. Like after a few years of that, it also becomes repetitive. It also becomes like, hey, is this really what I want to do? Do I want to go do something else? So I think everything that we do has a shelf life.
Yeah.
I think you get, when you get to a certain age, you got to start thinking about it. Maybe it's less about my career and more about my life, my personal life.
Yep.
Like honestly, like AWS was a fire hose. I mean, it was busy. It was
no pun intended for the team that works on that product.
Yeah, that's right. It was busy. It's literally around the clock, and it doesn't stop. And I was there for 6 years. Most people don't last that long.
No, you're a vet if you last that long.
When I left, like I felt such a weight lifted off of me, and I'm like, wow, I can actually go to my kids' soccer, to their kids' you know, concert. I used to be the idiot in the back of the room on a conference call while everybody is playing soccer, everybody is listening to a concert. I'm the one on a conference call, right?
Yeah. Like
now I can sit, I can enjoy it. And I think when you get to a point in your life where you're happy enough, you're good with your career, it's fulfilling enough, you're doing new things, focus on something else. Focus on your life. Focus on... Like my kids now are getting older, right? I have a 15-year-old, I have a 13-year-old, and 11-year-old. Like I want to take him.
Oh yeah.
I want to go to Europe with them. I want to do stuff like that, right? Like I want to spend time doing that rather than, you know, taking on solopreneurship, right? Like doing my own thing. And at that point, it's all on you, right? It's up to you to bring the money. So. And in that situation, it's okay to go find a corporate job that maybe is not perfect for you. Maybe it's not the most exciting and entertaining every single day of your of the rest of your life. But you know what? You get money. You get freedom. You can go take a week off. You can take 2 weeks off if you wanted to. You don't have to worry about anything. Right? So that's okay. Right? For me, I always have that itch. I always have the itch that I want to do something. I want to build something. That's I want to launch something. And I kind of find it in... either in personal projects or just find it in within a large company, joining a new team within a large company or joining a startup, kind of let somebody else take the burden of, you know, stability and let me do the fun stuff of launching. And that's kind of how I scratch my itch, but still have a sort of safe landing zone. So the wife is happy and the kids are happy.
It does help.
Exactly. That's the important stuff.
Yeah.
If I was single, it'd be a different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or slightly crazier. So it's like,
crazier, right? So some people are just like, I need to do this. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's all right. You know, like I said, like, again, like when I get to like the 40s, 50s, that's where I feel like I want to settle a little bit in my career.
I've
put in the time, I put in the effort. I want to go, I want to travel. I want to see stuff. I want to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Especially with kids like your age, and I have kids that are 13 and 10, so in the same boat. Like, you just know, like, you know, especially your oldest kid, there's not a lot of days you're going to be like spending with them. There's days you spend every day, but it's, I mean, how often are you spending like the real quality time where it's, you know, it's dad and kid, day, right? I mean, those are like, you can count them probably on your hands.
When I drive them to school.
Right. Right. Yeah. So it's those moments, you know, and you kind of look at it from that perspective, and you know, pretty soon they're going to be out. Especially once your kid turns like 16, starts driving. I mean, they're basically an adult at that point. I mean, they have two years legally, but like they're like, yeah, that's cool, Roy. See you later. And they start calling you by your first name.
My middle daughter already does that. I'm like, hold on.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's the reality of it, dude. And I mean, even my 13-year-old, we're already talking about college and whatnot. And he wants, you know, so it's just, it's interesting just seeing sort of how everything goes. And pretty soon they'll have jobs and be able to start this whole cycle over again or not have jobs. I don't know.
With social media, especially LinkedIn and you know, newsletters and all that stuff, there's so much FOMO going around.
Yeah,
I see all these people doing like their own stuff. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. I can do this. First of all, I don't know their full story. I don't know how many painful hours you put into everything that you created. So for me to even imagine that I can build something like you did right now is an illusion, right? Like, it's going to take a lot of work and effort to build what you built. And it's, you know, I think people need to realize that.
I mean, it's so true. Like you know, I get a lot of people saying, how can I, you know, write a book like you did? And I was like, that's impossible. I mean, I don't think I could replicate that. Right. But it's like, luck is one thing, but timing is another, which is part of luck. And I think just setting yourself up for good opportunities, but then it's just like we were talking about earlier, just the ability to just grind it out every day. And like, I mean, and especially what I do, like, I don't have a steady paycheck. Right. Like I prefer it that way. Cause I think that's just what I'm used to. I think if I went to a job, I would probably go insane actually. Cause I'm like, it's the predictability. Maybe I could, who knows, depends on the right company, but it's like, but there's a certain sense of, I think from the outside in, it looks like, you know, everything's really awesome and cool, but everybody I know, especially entrepreneurs, I mean, you're bordering on like some mild level of psychosis any given day. It's not for the faint of heart. I can tell you, anyone this.
Like, but most people see the success. They don't see your failures, right? And when people kind of look broad strokes at what everybody's doing, and especially in social media, everything is bubbles up to the top.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of look at it and you say like, oh my God, maybe I can do this. That looks fun. Maybe I should do this. But it's not for everybody. Right? Honestly, like, do I want to build a media empire right now? Like you're building? I don't know. I mean, it's not really for me. Like maybe I want to do something else, but
yeah,
you know, so I think you really got to think about your priorities. Like social media is so good at throwing like the awesome stuff in your face and making you feel like you're missing out. Like, I think people need to really step back and reevaluate what's important to them and not fall into the trap of, you know, I want to live somebody else's dreams. It's not yours. It's not always yours. And it's a lot of work. It takes a lot of time to get there.
Right? Oh, dude, it does. You know, and people ask about my travel. They think that's glamorous. I mean, I can't tell you how depressing it is sometimes. I'll be on the plane going overseas, you know, or coming back home. And I will literally sometimes be so sad. I'll just go to the toilet and the plane and just start crying. Like, it sucks. I miss my kids.
Yeah, I hate hearing that.
Yeah, it's like just that stuff messes with you, dude. And it's like that's the reality of it.
I've traveled for probably 15 so years out of my career.
Yeah.
And similar to you, like, I was on the road every single week. Like, I think I'd get like maybe 1 or 2 weeks out of the year off for like the holidays and the year. But besides that, I was on the road every week.
Jesus.
And, you know, you go into some fun countries. Yeah, you do some fun stuff. But at the end of the day, it's just you.
It's just you.
It's just you walking around the streets and you're like, oh, cool. cool. I love this card. I love traveling, but it takes a big toll. It takes a big toll on your family.
Big time in the family. No, yeah, they don't see you. No, you become like a rectangle on like a FaceTime call, you know, and that's,
that's right.
You
that's
know,
right. At least we have FaceTime call now. When I did it, there was no FaceTime call. So it'd just be a phone call.
Back in the day, it's phone calls. And that was expensive back then because it's all international calls. You're traveling international, so you have to, if you try and call collect, you're like, what are you doing?
I've seen a lot of cool stuff, which is the fun part of it. But something had to give.
Yeah. So what's next for you, man? Like, what are you excited about?
Honestly, like we're Apache Iceberg and the whole lake house thing. So like for me, like I look at technology as a pendulum, right? We tend to sort of like swing to one side in 1 year, and then a couple years later, we swing to the other side. So like in the data space, from a platform architecture perspective, like we had this, on-prem warehouses, then the technology kind of swung over to the cloud. We built cloud-native warehouses like Redshift and BigQuery. And then the technology pendulum kind of swung back to the left and like, hey, we want to go back to Hadoop. We want to go back to these data lakey things because it's open, it's cheaper, it's blah, 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 right? Then we kind of ran into some issues. A lot of people picked it up, but still was struggling with it. And then the shiny new object came around, Snowflake. It says, hey, I got a better way to do cloud native warehousing. Let's do that. Everybody shifted, right? So the pendulum swung that way. The whole industry went there. Everybody's doing it. All the partners are building for it. We also did that at Upsolver too. We kind of followed that lead a little bit. But now the pendulum is swinging back because the value of Data Lake is still there. It is significantly cheaper than building stuff on top of a warehouse. It is much more open, less lock-in. Ubiquitous access is a big, big deal because not everything is analytics, right? Just running queries and dashboards and reports isn't everything. There's so much other stuff you can do with data that you're not going to do inside of a warehouse. So, but the complexity of data lakes still exists. So now the technology have optimized that, and we have things like Apache Iceberg and Hoodie and Delta that are helping us kind of eliminate some of those complexities that existed on the lake. So I really think over the next 2 years, we're going to start seeing a shift back towards the lake house and the maturity of some of those table format technologies like Iceberg and Hoodie. So that's kind of what's really exciting me right now is like, how do we take what we've built and what we've done in the warehouse and transitioning into a more open modern data stack, right? That's not tied to a couple vendors, but is much more decoupled and easier to manage because of this new technology. And that's kind of the big bet that we made at Upsolver as well, is that we support warehouses like Redshift and Snowflake. That's not a big deal. We support data lakes as well. We help you build on data lakes, but we're really banking on Iceberg being kind of the next big thing because cost is a huge deal for the next few years, right? The economy is going to slowly recover, but cost is going to be a big deal for everybody.
Yeah.
Openness is going to be a big deal because nobody wants to migrate from one tool to the other. It's just too much work and it's too expensive. And if you want to be on a cutting edge, like you need to be able to bring in the next new tool in a market to use your data. Like Snowflake's great, it's going to be around for a while, but you know what? Maybe the roadmap doesn't quite align with what I want to do and I want to go use product X, right? Like DuckDB or whatever that may be. I want to be able to just use the same data without migrating or exporting it from one system to the other. So that's really what's getting me excited these days. I think the cross-cloud, kind of cross-cloud analytics is going to be a big deal, and Iceberg and these lakehouse formats going to help there.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of some of the innovation around catalogs. We have a lot of these discovery catalogs or like Adlin and AcroData and those that are really good at discovery of the data, but they still aren't helping us in actually accessing the data.
Yeah.
When I run a query, my query planner doesn't talk to Adlin. It talks to Glue, right? So what does that look like? How do we sort of consolidate those things? Because there's a lot of additional information in Adlin and AcroData can provide a query planner to make better decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Security related stuff. So there's a lot of things that are gonna happen. But for me, it's that swing back to the lake house, the cross-cloud unification of data and data access is the exciting stuff. And then what are we going to build on top of that? I'm not, to be honest, like Gen AI and all that kind of stuff is cool. It's a really cool toy. You know, stuff's going to happen with it. It's not, to me, it's just putting more lipstick on a pig. Like it's great, but until the big use case come out of it, it's just noise. You know, everybody's going to have a co-pilot. Everybody's going to have, you know, like ask my like chat bots with LLMs built in.
Yeah, I think it's really the use case for it too. It's a conversational mechanism, and I always use it just for like generating stupid images and stuff.
You know,
it's remarkably good, I think, at even just being a just something to chat with. I mean, I use it all the time just to check my ideas and so forth. But yeah, it's I've been trying to think of like basically the intersection of like LLMs and data tooling. And I think the idea I've arrived at really is I don't see a scenario where generative AI necessarily grows the total addressable market of data tooling. Because it just becomes another feature. It's just like if every BI tool used to not have visualizations and now they do,
right.
Then that's table stakes. And therefore the market hasn't necessarily grown. It just incorporates a new feature. And that's what I'm seeing right now. Like I think with a lot of data tooling, especially BI vendors, it's like and catalogs too, and it's like this is table stakes. So, but it's it's not gonna make anyone more interested in these more products though. It's like, oh, now that they have that, I'll use it, right?
It's like, right. But most companies that slap on Gen AI, like it's not monetizable. Like it's used as a hook because it's the cool thing and that's what everybody wants to see. So yes, of course I have it too, but it's not a feature that you can charge money for. Mm-hmm. It's not a feature that you know, is truly changing the way you work with the product. I mean, okay, so you can ask a question, you can ask it to build SQL. It kind of does something basic. Maybe you can run it, maybe you have to tweak it. It's gonna get better. I mean, there's no question about it. It's gonna get better and stronger and awesome, but I feel it's very much a dev experience. It's very much kind of like making things a little easier for you, making things just simpler for users, so more users can get into it, which is great. But I'm looking forward to do more than that. Like I really want like an LLM, and maybe it's not the right model for that, but I really want like some kind of ML model that understands the query planner. Right, understands how to plan queries and optimize queries. So when it writes me a SQL query, it actually does a really good job because it knows it's talking to Spark or to Presto or to Snowflake, and it gives me a query that's optimized for that. Now that's more meaningful to me.
Yeah, right? I also think you touched on something I think is really interesting too, and this is something I've been thinking about in the context of the upcoming talk I'm going to give at your conference, the Chill Data Summit, by the way. If you haven't registered for it, go for it. But it's really, you know, there's a notion of open table formats. And I think that this is sort of the beginning of, I think, a broader secular trend where you're going to see, I think, not just open analytical formats, but it's sort of what happened with Postgres, where you started having the extensibility of the Postgres ecosystem. That was one of the tenets of Postgres, is that it should be extensible.
Right.
When Stonebreaker came up with Postgres. And I feel this is very much going to be similar with open table formats. So I think these will at some point be de facto, but then it's not just analytical. You might be talking vector use cases. You might be talking a bunch of other things. And the thing that might sit on top of that is some sort of semantic layer that holds all this together. Semantic layer is a kind of an overloaded term, but overarching way of looking at the data. And so I think that's where it's evolving.
Yeah, I think as an industry, we need to start thinking beyond analytics.
Oh, we do, for sure.
You know, like what else are you doing with data? Like embedded analytics inside of applications. Embedded.
Well, software engineering, I mean, apps, they have data. Yeah. That's where it all comes from, by the way.
Exactly.
So it's like, data people, we just conveniently ignore it. Cause it's like, when we talk about data modeling, it's we always focus on the subset, but it's like, you realize that there's other use cases besides that. Right. So
we got the iceberg, right? We're the tip of the iceberg with analytics. There's so much more that you can do with data that we really haven't really talked about. And the industry as a whole, like, I feel like focuses on analytics too much, in kind of like the analytics use case. Like I'm trying to kind of, you know, in on LinkedIn, if you see, like I try to kind of break it out a bit more and talk a little bit more about things outside of analytics, instead of the use case of analytics, because that's where the real power of data is. Mm-hmm. Right. And you mentioned it. So we're launching our first conference, the Chill Data Summit in New York City in February. So that's really, really exciting. A lot of work goes into it.
Yeah.
But the intention is to kind of rally the community around lake houses, rally them around Iceberg as a format, and be very educational, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you come to this conference, like you're gonna listen to a bunch of sessions that will improve your understanding and your abilities to deliver on a lake house solution for your company. So when you leave that, you're gonna go to your boss and you're gonna say, "I'm the Iceberg expert. Let's go talk about lake houses and how to do it." All right. So I'm really excited. February 6th, New York City. A little bit cold, but it's okay. The city is awesome. It's going to be a nice venue, some good food. And then after that, we're actually going to be Ethan Aaron is doing the low-key data happy hour in New York City on that day. So we're all going to leave the conference, go together to the bar, and drink and have a good time. But we will not give anybody a microphone to speak too much. Just drink and enjoy.
Those happy hours are fun. Can't wait to get back. That's right. So awesome. It was great chatting with you. I definitely think that the conversation took an interesting turn, but I'm happy with it. The career progression, I think, is definitely a big topic that I is. Yeah, there's good talks about a lot. I was glad to understand your trajectory of it all and the conversation we had. So thanks, Roy.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you giving the time to chat with you. I always love talking to you. And
likewise.
I'll see you at the Chill Data Summit. I'll see you at Data Day Texas. So we'll definitely
Day Texas.
See
that's around. Right. That's the other one. So if you're, I guess when this comes out, it'll probably be around the time of Data Day Texas. But if you happen to be in Austin, come to Data Day Texas. It's at the AT&T Conference Center, I think. But it's a conference it's a party that masquerades as a conference. It's on a Saturday too, which I think is interesting. But
I think it's the only conference that does that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
I had to get permission from the wife to go, so I'm ready to go.
Oh dear. Awesome.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It was awesome.
Anytime,
chatting with you.
Take it easy.
All right, man.